and welcome to British Eugenics. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. And my co-host for this episode will be Max Musson from Western Spring. And today we will be talking about euthanasia.
Well, we finished with our British eugenics presentation in the last episode, and we have another presentation on eugenics to get into this week, but it's not specifically British. It's talking about Greek and Roman eugenics, and particularly about the euthanasia side of it. Obviously, something which is going to cause quite a bit of discussion about, I think, you know, the positive nature of it, the negative nature of it. And it's a terrible thing to see what's happening at the moment with some of these countries like Canada and Switzerland, which are just making it easier and easier for people to kill themselves. They even have this pod now, a portable pod, which is basically a portable gas chamber. And if people want to off themselves, they can just go into this chamber, which is an absolutely terrible state of affairs. And euthanasia does form a part of eugenics, so it is a discussion that we are going to have. Obviously, we condemn the idea of the state effectively executing people, but if you're not going to have that, then there needs to be some other ways of preventing negative genetics making their way into the general population. And of course, today we have genetic screening, which we can use. We can also see the fetus when somebody is pregnant. We can see whether they're going to be disabled or not. So before somebody is actually born, we can prevent that from happening and prevent that from making its way into the general population. But years ago, they weren't able to do that. So what we have today, we have a presentation on ancient eugenics and the euthanasia side of it. And this actually comes from a Substack called Forbidden Knowledge, where they say, reviewing and commenting on the forbidden literature of philosophers, the misunderstood texts of societies, and the forgotten tales of our past. And they begin by saying, as a people, a family, a clan, a tribe, or even a nation, the health of the group depends on individual choices, both in who the individuals choose to procreate with and who the individuals choose to bar from procreation, or in the extreme, kill entirely. These choices that lead to either a replication of healthy genes or the improvement of the overall genetics of a people are called eugenics. Ultimately, what the law permits and what the society encourages is what will decide the outcome of the health of their own people. To understand eugenics, one must ground themselves in the understanding of its etymology. Eugenics can be broken down into two roots, EU meaning good, and genics meaning origin or birth. So quite literally, it means good origin or good birth. And we've covered this before, I know. We're just going over it again for a second time. Eugenics involves every decision around the promotion of procreation of healthy members of the society and the demotion of procreation of the unhealthy members of the society. How these eugenic practices are carried out has changed over time and from civilization to civilization, but the outcome is fundamentally the same. And we've mainly talked about the positive eugenics before. And now this is the negative eugenics, euthanasia. If eugenics thus means of good origin, what does the term euthanasia mean? Euthanasia can also be broken down into two roots, EU, which again means good, and thanatos, or death. So euthanasia means good death, but what does a good death mean? What did it mean to the Greeks and the Romans? To the Greco-Romans, a good death would have been considered something along the lines of a dignified death, one without whimpering and cowardice. Today, euthanasia means something along the lines of an easy death, one without pain or suffering. The meaning has slightly shifted, and this is a reflection of the societies that keep their meaning alive. A different view of euthanasia could be that the death was for the good of the health of the society. But how could a death be good? One could view a people as a living organism, and each person as an individual cell. When a healthy body has sick cells, it sends its antibodies to kill the sickly cells for the good of the healthy cells. Another analogy could be a gardener represented by the hand of the society. When a gardener recognizes a sickly leaf infected with parasites, fungus, or a disease, he will choose to shear off the infected leaf or forsake the plant entirely to otherwise save his garden. So this is something that went on in the past that doesn't go on today. And obviously we have a considerable number of weak and sickly people that are living today as a result of the advance of medical technology. And in the past, something was done about this, which we will get into, but that's not being done today. So I would suggest that there has to be found something else, another mechanism that can be used to prevent the introduction of weak genetics into the general population. As I said there at the beginning, I think genetic screening would help with that, and also encouraging the people that do have weak genetics not to breed, rather than what went on in the past, which, as we'll get into, which is when somebody was born and they were deformed or they were sickly, then they were exposed to the elements, basically. Obviously not something anybody would want to have to do, but they did have to do this in the past. Otherwise, the nation could end up being filled with weak and sickly people, and they could end up being taken over by another nation. So, you know, it was just a very uncomfortable fact of life, basically. I think that will do for the introduction here. Max, what are your views on this?
Well, we have kind of touched on these subjects quite a bit in the past. I think that in times gone by, when science was nowhere near as advanced as it is today, and where surgery was nowhere near as skillful, where obviously there was no knowledge of genetics and no knowledge of genetic engineering or genetic modifications or any sort of kind of gene therapies that can be available today. And so people took what appeared to be more sort of direct and brutal methods in order to cull those sections of the population that they felt would be a drain on their society and would cause their and would therefore be a burden that their society would have to carry, perhaps to its detriment if it was living in a very dangerous time when there was a lot of competition from other warlike peoples that surrounded them. Nowadays we're in a much better situation, I think, and there isn't any need nowadays, because of the science that we've developed over the centuries, there is no need for us to apply what people can regard as being negative eugenic principles or hard eugenics, where there is talk of people being euthanized, or where there's talk of people being sterilized. I don't think anything of that sort needs to be done nowadays, and it wouldn't be very popular if you were going to be advocating it. What needs to be done, though, is that there just needs to be, within the general education system, the morality of eugenics needs to be taught, so that children grow up realizing that there is a need for us to promote those elements within our population that are good and healthy, and to try to reduce those elements within our population that are not healthy and which can disadvantage us as a people. And the things you've mentioned, genetic screening, genetic engineering, and even without those, if you just simply discourage people who have undesirable characteristics, whether they be mental characteristics or physical characteristics, from having as many children, if you encourage them to have less children at a rate which is less than the replacement rate, then that will be a beneficial effect and will be eugenic. And if you encourage people who've got the more desirable characteristics to have larger than replacement levels of children, then that would be eugenic from the other direction. And in fact, you could just have a society that applied positive eugenics with regard to just solely encouraging those people with the most desirable physical and mental characteristics to have more children. That in itself would have a eugenic effect, and that in itself would mean that each successive generation would be better than the previous generation in all sorts of respects, and it would lead to the uplift of our civilization.
Yeah, and they didn't have those abilities back then to do that society-wide, so they had to use rather brutal methods to achieve the same. And I just also want to point out that, I don't believe there's any need for state-sanctioned euthanasia for people that get old and they think that, you know, that they're in a lot of pain and, you know, they should end their lives. There should be no need whatsoever for elderly people to be in pain. You know, if they're in pain, it's because their ability to acquire pain relievers, painkillers, has been restricted. I think there are far too many restrictions on doctors nowadays to actually ease people's pain when they get older. So I think a lot of people, you know, they might get frightened that, you know, when they're old, they might be in a lot of pain and they will be uncomfortable and they might end up wanting to end it all. And that's a terrible state of affairs, and that should never happen, because we do have the ability to get rid of most pain. Doctors have the ability to do that, and I think they should use that a lot more with the elderly. I don't like to see the elderly in pain, but as I say, that's another side to euthanasia. This is what we're mainly talking about today, is the eugenic side of it. Euthanasia cannot be done by the hand of doctors, however, or at least it should not be, for it goes against the Hippocratic oath, which every doctor must take. And of course, doctors nowadays, they go against that Hippocratic oath with abortion, and they also go against that Hippocratic oath with euthanasia. Hippocrates was an ancient Greek physician from Kos, a small island off the coast of Asia Minor. He created an oath, which is a promise and formal declaration made to another person, made in the watchful eye of God. The consequences of breaking an oath has always meant death, usually inflicted by God. And within the Hippocratic oath, there is a small section which says, "I will do no harm or injustice to them, neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so." There is much to be said about the Hippocratic Oath, but that deserves attention all of its own. For now, it is sufficient that you should know that doctors take an oath against intentionally harming or killing their patients, even when asking for a swift death. This shows that Greek doctors of the ancient world would not administer poisons to their patients to assist in killing them sooner. Greeks, however, did understand the burden placed upon a society by the sick. Now, while a temporary illness was viewed with pity and care, the burden of unfortunate lifelong disease and deformities was viewed in a different way, for they affect a society quite differently. In the wilderness, the permanently afflicted persons would typically die on their own. However, a civilization provides the necessary protection and care for these ill-born to live an unnaturally long life. And the Greeks and the Romans recognized this as a burden. And again, I'll just stop there. I mean, as I say, this Hippocratic oath, it does seem to me as if a lot of these doctors are ignoring this now. But the point that what he's really making here is that it's not just the fact that somebody who is born deformed is going to have problems looking after themselves. It's that society is going to have to look after them. And in the ancient world, if you got, you know, you don't have such access to resources that we have today. The whole of society has to work to look after the society. And if you've got somebody there that is just a burden, that isn't actually contributing, again, it's going to weaken the society. It's going to make it easier for another group to take them over, I think. So it's basically pointing out the fact that although these people back then, they would look after people that got ill, to allow somebody that was permanently ill from birth to live just meant that was going to be a huge burden on society. And I think really they're just looking at these things practically. I think if an animal in the wild gives birth to an animal that is weak or sickly, then that animal dies off. They allow it to die off. And that in some cases just happens naturally because they're not strong enough to get to the milk, or not strong enough to get there against the other animals that are in the, you know, that are there, that have been born with it. So naturally they would end up dying off. But obviously where we're human beings, we could take steps to ensure that a human being like that could live to adulthood. But if they did live to adulthood, it would mean that a certain portion of society was devoted to just taking care of that person and looking after them. And you couldn't really afford to do that, I don't think. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think that when one of the things you mentioned about was elderly people, and as somebody who's sort of getting towards that end, that life stage myself, I think that there is value in having a good death. And you sort of touched on this a little bit earlier. And I think that if for whatever reason, whether it be age or whether it be some sort of genetic mishap or whatever in your procreation, in your creation, I should say, in your birth, if somebody finds themselves in a condition where their life has and the quality of life has been reduced to the point where they don't actually want to carry on living, then they should have the option of euthanasia so that they can end that life. I don't think people should be put in a position where pressure is applied to them to conform with that or to make a decision one way or the other. I think that care should be taken to make sure that people aren't under duress. But where somebody clearly isn't under duress and where they have decided that life for them has become unbearable and they don't want to continue it, then they should be able to end it. I think also there are we're talking here about degrees of deformity, etc. There are lots of different shades of grey within this entire question, ranging from somebody who may have just a minor cosmetic problem which can be very easily and quickly put right, all the way through to somebody who would lead a life that nobody in their right mind would want to lead. And so, if it's known that a woman is carrying a child which when it's born is going to be grossly deformed and disfigured and unable to lead any kind of a normal life and probably won't even have the ability to make a rational decision themselves. They will lack mental capacity, as the phrase is. If you know that somebody's going to be born in that situation, then parents should have the right to sanction an abortion in order to relieve themselves of that. And I think that would be the right thing to do as well.
Yeah, and also I think that's a choice for when you were saying there about somebody old and, you know, that they have an illness or whatever and life becomes a great burden to them, then that is a choice for them to make if they want to end their life. I mean, what they're saying here is that doctors should not be doing that because they've taken this oath. If somebody wishes to end their life because they're just suffering too much, that's the responsibility of that person to make. And if they're not in their right mind, then really it's the responsibility of their family to make. But it's not the responsibility of the state, I don't think, and not the responsibility of the doctor. And this is the way that it was in the past, as we just said, that doctors could not do this because of the Hippocratic Oath. But we did have what was called the pater familias.
If I can just interject there, I think as far as doctors are concerned, the word poison covers a multitude of things. If you drink some things in excess, then they become poisonous. So, for example, if you drink alcohol in excess, that becomes a poison. If you take most medicines in excess, and every bottle of pills usually has a little notice on it saying do not exceed the stated dose, because if you exceed the stated dose, then that particular medication can become poisonous. And so doctors do quite routinely give patients pills to take that if they took them in all in one go would actually be lethal to them. And so I think as far as the Hippocratic Oath is concerned, I can see why people have interpreted it over the decades and the centuries and the way that they have. But I don't think the word poison, when the Hippocratic Oath was devised by Hippocrates, carries the same thing. I think he was thinking there of a doctor administering something which everybody knows is a poison in all circumstances, and where if you take that particular substance, it's likely to kill you irrespective of anything else. Whereas where there are other substances that you could ingest that would eventually be poisonous if you ingested sufficient quantities of them, they don't really qualify as poison.
Yeah, it's all to do with the quantity of them, isn't it? And I think the doctors are expecting you to take the recommended dose rather than to take them all together. So I think that's how they get around it, because all medicines are poisons, I should imagine, if taken in a sufficient quantity. Well, the paterfamilias is the title which means father of the family and also leader of the family. However, not every father was the leader of the family, for every male slave within the household was subject to the paterfamilias and therefore not the leader. So if you were a slave, then you couldn't be a paterfamilias, but the paterfamilias, the leader of the family, was responsible for the well-being of the slaves rather than the slave father. And this is a widespread Indo-European concept that stretches beyond the Greeks and the Romans. The fellow writing this says he hopes to revive awareness of the role of the father among his wife, his progeny, and society within his lifetime. The role of the paterfamilias within Greco-Roman society was not a light one, and the burden of choice which he must have borne was not easy but necessary. The paterfamilias was responsible for deciding whether his children lived or died immediately after birth, and it was a heavy burden to bear. The paterfamilias had to decide if his child was fit to live, and if the child was unfit, it was exposed to the elements and left to die or killed by the hand of the paterfamilias himself, whether the child was his own or was born by his slaves. Among the Greeks, Aristotle wrote in his book Politics, "As to exposing or rearing the child born, let there be a law that no deformed child shall be reared, but on the ground of number of children, if the regular customs hinder any of those born being exposed, there must be a limit fixed to the procreation of offspring. And if any people have a child as a result of intercourse, in contravention of these regulations, abortion must be practiced on it, the child." Aristotle, Politics, Part 16. Exposing a child deserves explanation. There are many ways in which a person could die, but exposure was a very prolonged and indirect method of death. In Indo-European cultures, it was taboo for a father to kill his son, or a family member to kill any other family member, for that matter. However, exposure was seen as the will of the gods. Exposure gave the child a chance at life. If the child was left alone, it would die in the elements or be killed by a wild beast. If the child, however, was found by those who took pity upon it, it was said that the gods had taken pity upon the child themselves and they were saved. Often these children were picked up by barren women or by those who ran religious orphanages. So this was the system, this was the law, that no deformed child should be reared. And at the same time, that comes up against the law that you're not allowed to kill any family members. So they would just expose a child to the elements. I mean, it seems very, very savage, but what was the other option? If that didn't happen, then you had these deformities and these congenital defects that were going to get introduced into the population. And you also had somebody that had to be looked after, which would be a burden upon the society. And as I say, it would weaken the society. Any thoughts on this, Max, or this concept of the paterfamilias?
I agree with what you've been saying. I think that the danger here is to assume that this sort of thing was happening sort of every other day, every other week, that there were, you know, babies being taken out and exposed on the mountaintops or whatever. These would have been fairly rare occurrences, and they would have been rare occurrences because they because of the fact that the practice existed. So once the practice existed, anybody that carried a deformity that would then manifest in their child would that their child would have been exposed, and so therefore the genes that caused that deformity of whatever it was wouldn't have been passed on into the next generation, and so therefore it would have become very rare that this sort of thing actually had to happen. And so, you know, thankfully it wouldn't be a pleasant task. I can see why, even though you may accept from a logical perspective that the paterfamilias should expose the child or kill the child, from an emotional perspective, it would be quite a difficult thing to reconcile with. I guess exposure on the mountainside was regarded as the lesser of two evils in that respect. It enabled you, if you had a belief in gods that are looking down upon you, it would be that you could excuse the fact that you had subjected an unfortunate child to a prolonged and horrible death. It would have been a prolonged and horrible death nonetheless. But as I say, it probably wouldn't have happened as often as we might imagine.
That's a really good point to make. I think that, it wouldn't have happened because they had this process in law. If anybody was born like that, then they wouldn't have made it to adulthood in order to pass those genes on. So the very fact they actually had this law would have meant that they didn't have any disabled people, apart from people that have been disabled during battle. But they would have had nobody that introduced congenital defects into the population because that they actually had this. And this idea of the paterfamilias, I mean, it's a lot of responsibility there that is placed on the head of the family. And nowadays we're seeing more and more responsibility is taken away from the parents and taken over by the state. But back then in this part of our development, there was far more responsibility actually held by the father. Supported by the much later Greek writer Plutarch, this quote shows the brutal nature of ancient life. And he says, "Nor was it in the power of the father to dispose of the child as he saw fit, as was his right in most heathen societies. He was obliged to carry the newborn child before certain men at a place called Leshe. These men were some of the elders of the tribe to which the child belonged, and their business was to carefully view the infant, and if they found it stout and well made, they gave order for its rearing and allotted to it one of the 9,000 shares of land mentioned for its maintenance. But if they found it puny and ill-shaped, they ordered it to be taken to what was called the apothetae, the depository, a large cave under Mount Taygetus in the Peloponnese, as thinking it neither for the good of the child itself nor for the public interest that it should be brought up, if it did not from the very outset appear to be healthy and vigorous." And that is Plutarch in Lycurgus 16 talking about Sparta. And he also says, "Heavy was the weight of choice for the father to decide to kill his own children or the children of his slaves for the good of the public interest according to the strength of his people. Yet it has always been a heavy crown to bear." And I think this forms a part of the movie 300, which is about the Spartans. I think at the beginning they hold up a child, and that's what's going on here. So in this instance, the responsibility is actually taken away from the father and is taken on by the state, and they observe the child and they decide whether the child is fit. If the child is fit, then he gets brought up, and he also gets a bit of land that is allotted to him. And if he was unfit, then obviously other people have got to work their bits of land in order to pay for this child or to provide the resources for this child to be brought up. And then once the child is brought up, it's just going to create more. So it's just introducing weakness. So I think this is possibly a better way of doing it because it puts the responsibility on the state. I guess this shows that they understood that it wasn't just all about the individual. It was about the group and about the way that your actions are going to affect the group, and the group takes precedence because the individual cannot survive without the group. And you know, that is really quite stark here, isn't it? Because without the group, you know, a child that is exposed is not going to survive. So it's the good of the group that comes before the good of the individual. Any thoughts on these quotes, Max?
Yes, I think it is a matter of looking at the good of a group, and I think that children nowadays, to a great extent, are brought up to think of themselves as individuals, and to think always individually. Is something good? How does it expect? How does it, or is it bad? How does it affect me as an individual? That's the way the thinking goes. Whereas societies where they had to exist in a hostile environment, where there would be a lack of natural resources, or where there would be perhaps hostile tribes living around them, or hostile nations who might try to attack them and take their land. You know, they had to be as strong as possible, and the strength of the individual was measured in the contribution that the individual made to the clan or the nation or whatever. That was something that was very important, and people probably would have thought collectively in those days than people tend to today.
Yes, and the Romans were no less brutal in the way they shaped society. During the early era of the Roman Republic, the many laws and customs of the people were codified into stone for all to see. In 449 BC, in what was called the Lex Tabularum, or as we know them, the 12 Tables. In the laws which deals with paternal powers, it was codified as follows. A notably deformed child shall be killed immediately. Table 4 of the 12 Tables of Roman Law. This connection between Roman laws and Greek laws makes sense if one understands that Greeks had a deep influence on the Romans, as much of the southern Italian peninsula was colonized by the Greeks and trade between the two was frequent. Seneca, the Roman statesman, wrote in his book on anger a passage about what a father would do to kill his child if he was stricken with grief and anger, instead of allowing the will of the gods to decide if a child lived or died. And he said, "A mad dogs we knock on the head, unnatural progeny we destroy, we drown even children at birth who are weakly and abnormal." And that's Seneca writing on anger, book 1, paragraph 15. This is quite clearly different from the method of allowing a child to die to the elements. But as was said earlier, the method of eugenics may differ, but the outcome is ultimately the same. The health of the society is protected. Ultimately, Valentinian outlawed the exposure of children in 374 AD in the Roman Empire, but those who continued the practice of eugenics were rarely, if ever, prosecuted for such acts. However, the practice did eventually die out shortly thereafter. So this was a part of our society many years ago, and we took it out, and I think it's because we took it out that we ended up with this increase in congenital deformities, and that then got increased at the time of the advancement of medical science about 200 years ago, and now we have lots of weak and sickly people, lots of disabled people. And I'm not suggesting that we should reinstate this and that deformed babies should be exposed to the elements, but we do have the ability to do genetic screening now. People can get genetically screened, find out if they have these weaknesses, and then they can take a decision that maybe it's not such a good idea to procreate. And people have procreated, if they have a scan and they discover that the child is going to have a deformity or is not going to be quite right, then really they should think about how this is going to affect society. And if we were all taught to identify not as individuals but to identify as part of the group, then obviously somebody that did find out that they were carrying a disabled child, then they probably would decide to terminate the child rather than bring it up and have this burden on the group. But I think because today everybody is taught to be individuals, I think some people will find out that the child is not going to be quite right, and they will choose to continue to have the child anyway, which does create the burden onto the group itself and runs the risk of reintroducing that weakness into the group. That's the thing, isn't it? So this was a part of our society. We wanted to prevent this. We knew that the good of the group came before the good of the individual, but I guess we just got squeamish about doing it. It is a brutal yet necessary topic to discuss, the topic of eugenics, but it would not be forbidden knowledge if it did not dismay some of our listeners by diving into the topic. We live in a society protected by civilization. Modern medicine can remedy many ailments in today's living, but a remedy is not a cure, and many diseases cannot be cured or deformities fixed. Since the dangers of the wild no longer cull the sick and the deformed to protect the genetic health of a people, some decision must be taken for the good of the people. In modern times, death is not the only means of preventing bad genetics from being passed down, and not all deformities and diseases can be prevented once and for all by mere eradication. I would refer to the killing of those with poor genetics or incurable diseases as hard eugenics. An easier and more manageable system of eugenics would be to encourage, educate, and incentivize those who are stricken by ill birth to not procreate. The methods of eugenics are divergent, but the outcome is the same. Be the practices heavy-handed or soft-handed, the overall problem of the accumulation of dysgenic genes within a modern civilization must be addressed. And that was really what Sir Francis Galton and the others 120 years ago were trying to prevent. They could foresee that there would be more and more weaker people that would be born into the nation, and that would just generally bring down the standards of the group, of the ethnicity. But it was done away with at the end of the Second World War, and you know, we really don't have any other way to prevent this. And so we just end up with lots and lots of disabled people, lots of mentally disabled people, and they all need looking after. And really all we should have to do is to tell people that you know, if they have genetic problems, it's not a good idea to breed, and it's just going to be a burden on society. As I say, we have modern ways that we can deal with this now. We have ways due to screening and what have you. But it's not really talked about in the way that it should be, I think. And eugenics are looked upon as being a negative thing because of the Second World War. And obviously, euthanasia in this way that it's been talked about here, that's frowned upon. And instead of having positive eugenics, what we have is dysgenics. We have the encouraging of dysgenic genes, and we have the idea of people having assisted suicide just because they get depressed in their 20s in some instances. It's like the reversal of the way that things should be. And also, I think because of this, because they implemented this, this is one of the reasons why when you look at these Greek statues and Roman statues, they're all perfect people. You don't see any representations of disabled, because they didn't have any disabled back then, purely and simply because they had this law. Any final thoughts on that, Max?
Well, really just that it's the... I don't think we necessarily need to focus too much on the danger of there being lots and lots of disabled people. Although, you know, I think that if you don't have some way of screening out the disadvantageous genes, then it will increase the proportion of disabled people within a society. The most important element of it, though, is not the numbers of disabled people, but the lack of exceptional people. And this is something that positive eugenics, encouraging people who've got exceptional qualities to have children at a rate which is in excess of the replacement rate, that's where the benefits of eugenics will be really felt. And what we need to do is to have a program where children are not just taught that it's the right thing to do to limit their fecundity if they've got unattractive characteristics or unhelpful characteristics, but where there are children who've got exceptional characteristics, exceptional abilities, that they should be encouraged to have more children, so that the proportion of people with those exceptional characteristics increases in society with each passing generation.
Yeah, we certainly need to get more and more geniuses born, and more people that are exceptional, and we do seem to be having a decreasing number of them. And again, that's I think a lot of that is to do with immigration, and we have this average IQ of the nation is gradually being lowered.
Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more from British Eugenics at Radio Albion in the future.